Well, thank you very much, Randy. I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me and your Imagine Solutions events here in Florida. I've been to a couple of them. They're fantastic, and I'm sure a number of you will have been there. But Randy has done a brilliant job in putting that together, and it goes from strength to strength. It's wonderful and a great honor to be here at the Forum Club. I'm very aware that you have extremely distinguished speakers. I see Supreme Court justices, senators, governors, and others on your roster. I also saw that you take pride in inviting people just a little bit before they become super famous often. So Norman Schwarzkopf was an example of that. And I'm hopeful that today is going to be but a prelude to some great things about to happen. Randy alluded to the fact that for the past 17 years, I've edited a publication, The World In, and then the title is whatever the next year is, so The World In 2020 is the latest edition. So I have sort of specialized in the future, but I've also edited a couple of books on The World In 2050. And that's what I thought I would talk to you about today. In the question and answer, I'm happy to answer any questions about more current or immediate short-term events. But the focus of my remarks is going to be the world in 2050, long-term trends, mega change in the world. And I'm going to highlight five big themes that I think are helping to shape the world of the next few decades. And, of course, part of the point of this is to throw light on the present. It helps, I think, looking at the long term helps to see current events and current trends in a clearer light, in a clearer perspective. So it's about the future, but it's also profoundly, I hope, about today. So five big themes. My first big theme, which really is, in a way, the fundamental one, is the population trends, the demography, that is actually very dramatic and changing the world in extraordinary ways. And it is one thing that you can forecast, not with total accuracy. Demography isn't entirely destiny, but you can have a pretty good idea of the broad sense of direction. And the impact of this, the implications of this, is so profound that it plays into all sorts of other areas of life. It happens, it plays out slowly, so it's happening all the time, every year, but taking this long-term view helps us to understand it better. So, what are a few of the major trends that are... First big one, if you looked ahead to 2050, you know, we're going to have another 2 billion or so people on the planet, with all the implications that brings of managing to sustain that number of people. And bear in mind, it took the entirety of human history to reach the stage in about 1800 where we reached our first billion in the world. Now we're at 7+ billion, and it took the move from 6 to 7 billion happened in just a very short space of time, only about a dozen years. So it's an astonishing speeding up. It's not going to carry on at that rate. It's going to plateau. But we're going to have an extra 2 billion people in the world. Of those 2 billion, half will be in Africa. So that tells you, in and of itself, that a great deal more focus on the African continent is going to be in order over the coming decades. If you're from Europe, there's a sort of mind-concentrating sense of our diminishing weight in the world. If you go back to 1950, which was the decade I was born, Europe was over 20% of the world's people. If you go forward to 2050, it'll be well under 10%. And if you look at Africa, it's the complete opposite. Africa was under 10% back in 1950, and it will be well over 20% in 2050. So huge, dramatic changes in the world. If you look in a little bit more detail about what the population is going to, the patterns within those 9 billion or so people on the planet, it's also fascinating and with huge with huge implications. I grew up to learn about something called the population pyramid, which I'm sure you all are familiar with. That if you look at the age profile of a population, it was very low, very wide, broad at the base. The biggest group was right at the bottom. And then if you go up in, let's say, 5 yearly intervals, it gets progressively smaller until you come to the top of the peak of the pyramid. Nowadays, that population pyramid has changed from, we've moved from, let's say, Egypt to St. Peter's in Rome. It's much more of a dome shape. So if you can picture that, we don't have charts here, so I can't show it to you, but you can picture the move from a pyramid to a dome. The base has got smaller because there are fewer, the birth rate has, the fertility rates have declined, and people are living longer, so there's a bulge working its way through to create this sort of dome at the top, and there's a larger number of people living to ripe age. And then if you go forward to 2050, we move into much more of a pillar shape. Again, further narrowing at the base and many, many more people at the top of the pyramid. The top of the pillar. So the implications of that are, of course, that you have a far smaller base to support the much larger number of people who are in the older age groups, and that has implications for our health systems, for our pension systems, for our labor markets, for our just about anything you care to mention. So right there's another huge implication of these extraordinary population trends. Another way of dividing up the world's population trends is areas of the world that are still having relatively vigorous growth birth rates and have relatively young populations, areas of the world that are aging very rapidly. So among the areas of the world that are aging very rapidly are, of course, well-known. Japan has perhaps among the developed countries dramatically, and again with huge implications for the way they organize their society and their economy. And quite interesting, therefore, to look at Japan and how it adjusts to that change, because it's ahead of the curve in finding ways, new technologies, new solutions to some of these the challenges and also the opportunities that arise from that. But then in Europe, there are plenty of countries that are following in those footsteps. Italy, for example, a lot of the countries in southern Europe have astonishingly low birth rates. So those are countries with small or declining populations, with declining populations and aging populations. And the surprising country that may surprise you, I think, in that category is China. China is also going to have a very rapidly aging population. That's why people sometimes say China is in a race to go rich before it grows old. Then you have the more dynamic countries that have young populations. Still, Africa, I mentioned, clearly there's an absolute explosion of young people coming onto the workforce in Africa. Great opportunity for Africa if the conditions are such that economic opportunity can be found for all those people. There's a potential for an economic boom, but also potential for something much more difficult if the conditions are less stable and the economy doesn't absorb all those people coming onto the labor force. So Africa, India also another area, parts of the Middle East, very young, dynamic. And then there are parts of the world that are somewhere in the middle, and the United States is in that sort of middle area. Southeast Asia, a lot of Latin America is in the sort of middle group. Very broadly, just mention one other, a couple of other perhaps, broad population trends. One is very important, the urbanization of the world. So we just a few years ago passed the point where half of us on the planet live in towns and cities. We're urban rather than rural. For most of human history, we were overwhelmingly rural and cities and towns came along rather late in the day. Now we're half urban. By 2050, will be about 70% or close to 70% urban. So the future of the world is largely the future of towns and cities. The other big trend is the overall aging of the population, which is quite substantial. If you look at the median age of the population, it's rising by a large amount. So these are vast population trends about which we by now can do very little. They're going to happen. This is the world that we're going to have to adjust to. So that's the first major set of issues that I think helps us understand the future, and also helps us understand how even today we're starting to have to adjust to a lot of these things. Second is the economy, the overall pattern of the world economy. And part of this is actually influenced very heavily by these demographic trends, because where there are more people, there's obviously more economic activity. And the broad picture here, there's an economist who calculates the global center of gravity of the world. And that global center of gravity, back when I was growing up, was somewhere mid-Atlantic. And that sort of intuitively makes sense. This was the part of the world that was that had the most economic activity, America, Europe. But it's been shifting gradually eastwards, or quite rapidly eastwards, actually, in recent times. And it's now somewhere, around the Middle East. And it will be moving further east towards, let's say, somewhere between the China and India border by 2050. So that, if you have a mental picture of this, world center of gravity moving from mid-Atlantic right over towards China, India, that's the way the world is going. You see the extraordinary rise, if you look at the share of the world's economy that is taken by different economic regions of the world, the Asian share is rising very strikingly because of China's extraordinary growth. Before that, we had extraordinary Japanese growth and Southeast Asian growth. Next, we're surely going to have extraordinary Indian growth as well. So by 2050, well over half of the world's economy is going to be in Asia. And that is actually, it really is back to the future, because again, for most of human history, before you had the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolutions in Europe and then in the United States, Asia was the most populous and producing the biggest share of the world economy. We're going back to that same pattern, if you like. But again, that is an extraordinarily important fact, along with the demographic change, that will influence the way that businesses work, that economies, that companies have to think about the future. That sheer fact of the weight of economic output shifting towards the east. And that leads on to my third big theme, which is on geopolitics and the way that is changing. And I think the big shift over the next decades is one that we're already seeing, which is to do with the rise of China. We've seen, I've talked about the rise of China economically, but for the first time we have a power rising in the world which is going to have an enormous amount, not only of military muscle, but also economic power. And this is different from the old challenge that we had in decades past with the old Soviet Union, where you had a rival superpower that was extraordinarily powerful, still is in its Russian successor state, extraordinarily powerful militarily, armed with nuclear weapons and so on, but was always relatively weak economically. It was always only a fraction of the American size of the American economy. In China, you have a power which is going to be overtaking the United States in terms of overall economic size. By some measures, it already has, but if you measure it by market exchange rates, still some way behind, but it will be overtaking, still growing relatively fast. And militarily, it's building up extremely rapidly. First of all, in its own neighborhood, South China Sea, and so on, but increasingly with ambitions far and wide. And it has its Belt and Road Initiative, which is one way of getting hold of and in being involved in the construction of infrastructure around the world, which China can, in some cases, actually get to own or operate eventually. So China is a formidable rising power of a sort of a nature that the United States and the West more broadly has not had to face before. And historically, the transfer between one ascendant power and a rising power is a very, very difficult thing to manage smoothly. Place after place, you will feel the existing power challenged by the rising power, and you just have to hope that this challenge can be managed smoothly, without conflict, certainly without major military conflict breaking out. But it's a very, very tricky thing to handle, and it's something that is going to be exercising, I think, all of us in the decades ahead, because this is not something that begins and ends at a certain defined period quickly. It plays out over a long period of time. And you can see this happening now again and again, trying to puzzle out how to deal with, handle this relationship with China. You see it causing difficulties among allies as to how seriously to take it. And it's across many dimensions. I don't think this is a particular, by the way, partisan issue in Washington these days. President Trump has certainly focused attention on this, like to a greater extent than previous administrations. But you have Democrats and Republicans alike extremely concerned by China's power across a number of dimensions. Economic power, of course, and whether China plays fair in according to the rules that we have, but also its growing military power and its authoritarian model. Now, China is different from the old Soviet Union in that it does not come with the same sort of ideological, if you like, aggression that the Soviet Union had. But it is authoritarian. It's nominally Marxist as well, but it's primarily authoritarian and presents to the world a rival idea, a rival model of authoritarian way of running things, which it claims its own success helps to justify. And that becomes, I think, something that the West also has to face up to. It faces a rival system of organizing or attitude to the way of organizing a society. So we see playing out right now some of this decades-long tussle between America and China, figuring out how to live alongside each other. You see it, for example, in military cat-and-mouse games in the South China Sea, where America asserts the right to navigation across international waters. China asserts its what it claims to be very wide-ranging territorial claims in the region, starting to build military bases. You see it in trade wars. We have a truce right now, but the trade tussle is going to be carrying on for a long time. You see it, I think, not least and most awkwardly for many of America's allies, on the technology front, and the question of who gets to control the fundamental basic platforms of technology in the decades ahead. So this battle over Huawei, the market leader in 5G, the next generation of telecoms equipment, this has become a sort of litmus of attitudes towards China. And the United States has decided that it cannot afford to let China dominate this future platform of the next generation of technology. And allies around the world have to decide whether they fall in line with that or whether they do something different. My own country has just taken a big decision on China, which was an attempt at a compromise, but it's caused friction between even two close allies like the United States and Britain. Australia has decided to ban Huawei. Other countries are still facing that tricky decision. This is the sort of thing If you go around, if you travel around Asia, for example, and you find countries, in many cases, China is their biggest trading partner, the United States is their biggest security ally. How do they resist pressure from China on political and security issues when they are so dependent on it for trade reasons? This is a big drama that is going to be playing out in the decades ahead. So that's the third theme. Fourth theme is a more wishy-washy one, but I think it's also important. It's the big cultural changes that will change our world in the next decades. And if you think about it, the cultural changes that we have lived through in the past three or four decades are really rather stunning. Different ideas of, for example, women's role in the workplace. It's a totally different world now than it was before. Different ideas of marriage, different examples of marriage. You know, we had on the cover of The Economist 25 or so years ago an article, a leader, making the case for same-sex marriage, but never believing that it would actually happen in our lifetimes. And now it's legal in many parts of the world, and it's still controversial in many places, but it's an astonishing change, and we will have other similar changes in the decades ahead. So one sort of parlor game that you can play at home to try to speculate as to what the big cultural changes might be in the decades ahead is, what are we doing today that are perhaps tomorrow's taboos? Right, so every generation has these. So whether it was, women didn't have the right to vote in previous generations, or there was slavery, or whatever it might be, nowadays we look back and say, how could they think that this was justified? But at the time, it was widespread, widely accepted. So what is it today that we take for granted that we can do, that tomorrow, in two or three decades' time, will be considered absolutely taboo or wrong? And I just offer perhaps a couple of thoughts on this, and then I would encourage you to speculate it around the dinner party at the dinner table at home. One thought is that in the year 2020, they knew that we had a serious problem of climate change, and yet you did far, far too little to tackle it. You just didn't take the action that was needed to make a difference. Now, you may agree or disagree with that. That's just a suggestion that this would be something that in two or three decades' time, people will reproach our generation for being blind to. Maybe that in two or three decades' time, eating meat will be taboo. Maybe by then, artificial meat will be so good and so varied and so cheap, because the technology has advanced to that extent, that artificial alternatives to meat, or just no meat at all, will be the way that many, many parts of the world think that it's the right way to eat. So those are just suggestions. They may be completely wrong, but they're thoughts for the way that the cultural change may happen in future. And then my final fifth and final theme for what is going to shape the world of the coming decades is to do with technology. And it's an obvious thing to say. You clearly know that technology is changing our lives on a daily basis. You currently have been asked to switch all your phones off and your watches, but just a few short years ago, you wouldn't have had these mobile phones. You wouldn't have had the world of knowledge at your fingertips that you have today. And the whole internet didn't exist, but now it fundamentally changes us. And of course, it's very hard to know with technology what will be coming up in the decades ahead. Almost by definition, things that we can't even imagine now will be there in the future. But in the book on technology in 2050 that I edited a couple of years ago, I think it is possible to say a few things about about the world of technology that help us understand how it will be. One is that it's speeding up for a number of reasons. If you look at the pace of change, the pace of technological change is speeding up. If you look at the fundamentals of science, we know we can model the way the world works much more effectively with the help of very powerful computers and equations that we've figured out in a way that means we can, in future, proceed to invent things through computerization rather than through trial and error in the same way, which just makes it much quicker. If you look at the world of biotechnology and biology, we have just begun the journey of understanding the implications of of decoding the genome and the ability to edit genomes. This is very early stage, but it's unlocking a huge a range of potential discoveries, not least in the healthcare area, but in all sorts of other areas as well. So we're just on the beginnings of a journey on personalized medicine, for example, of understanding much better cures for diseases such as or complexities and cures for any number of diseases. So it's speeding up, that's number one. Number two, we can be pretty sure that there will be unintended consequences of the developments that we have. So we see this right now. If you remember the early days of the internet, there was such excitement about the brave new world it was going to bring, and it was all going to be good. But we discover that, of course, humanity being humanity, it can be bad as well as good, and we're now rushing to catch up with some of the negative consequences of the digital age. There can be bad players as well as good players online. There's a dark side to the web. There's crime as well as a lot of benign activity. We can worry about whether our data are well responsibly looked after, so there are all sorts of privacy issues as well. And guess what? There's antitrust issues as well in the internet era, as there have been in previous eras too. So the tech giants do extraordinary things, but they're also extraordinarily powerful, and we don't necessarily trust the degree of power that they have. So all these things are now, we're rushing to catch up with the issues that are created by this. And that's before we get on to questions like artificial intelligence and machine learning and how that may impact anything from the labor market to warfare. So we're just beginning, again, to get our minds around what the implications for that are. So unintended consequences that we will need to struggle with. And then I think something that is on many people's minds is, what does it mean for our economies and for the way that we organize life? Will there be jobs in the future if the machines get so good? What should we train our children and grandchildren to do? What should we encourage them to learn in such a world that is going to be moving, changing very quickly? And the one sort of near certainty I would offer you on that front is that there will be jobs, there will clearly be a lot of disruption, but there will also be jobs that we can't even imagine today. When people talk about this, they tend to take a rather static view of the way that the economy works and the way that labor markets function. And we think that this category of person might be completely out of work and there will be nothing for them to do. In fact, we invent new things to do the whole time. We underestimate the human capacity to come up with new solutions, new needs, whole categories of jobs. Category that I like to mention is drone operators. The idea that, you know, this didn't exist before. Who thought that there would have been drone operators, a major employer of both in the military and the civil area, and also for recreational use? It's now a big area of economic activity, and yet it didn't exist before. Or app designers, for example, there weren't even apps before. Suddenly you have countless numbers of people working on these things. So there will be all sorts of new areas of activity, of economic activity. It doesn't mean that the disruption and that the adjustment to this world is going to be simple. The people who are displaced from old jobs won't necessarily be the people who are best suited for the new economy. and it won't necessarily, the new jobs won't necessarily come along at the same pace as the old jobs are destroyed. But fundamentally, I think this great churning of the labour market will be the most important factor of it. And it's interesting, isn't it, that today, at a time when people have been so worried for a number of years about how technology is going to destroy all our jobs and steal our livelihoods, actually there's a shortage of labour in so many areas. We have record employment in this country, in my country as well. And it's employers, if you talk to them, are desperate for the skills of the new economy that are often in short supply. So that's just a few, large thoughts about what will affect the future. I'm very happy to take more mundane questions about current thing. There are small matters like Brexit you might be interested in. The one thing I would say, though, in conclusion to my big picture on the future, is that I'm a whole lot more confident about it, having heard the students of Collier County today, who are just fantastic. Thank you very much.
Why don't you do two things? One, we want to say thank you to Daniel, and we have a gift for you. And the second is, we have a raft of questions, and there's no way we're going to get to all of them. So let me start with some, and we'll start with some of our students. And I'm going to interpret some of these, because handwriting, whether you're left-handed or right-handed or non-Catholic, is a challenge for me. One of the questions from the students, and has been echoed by others, is about the virus that we're seeing right now. Where are we? What solution do we have? How does that impact China or the rest of the world?
Yeah. Well, we're not in a very good place. I think it's a...
Is this on?
Yeah. It's clearly a big worry, and it's already causing major disruption. You've seen the number of flights that are now, or airlines that are no longer flying into China. You've seen, obviously, the quarantine of the cruise liner. And beyond the most visible impacts, any number of lesser seen impacts of supply chains that are now many boardrooms are grappling with how they're going to get their supplies, because China is such a major supplier and such a big factor in the global supply chains. A lot of people are thinking, well, I'm not going to plan that trip to China. One of the big worries now looming on the horizon is the Olympics. There's the Tokyo Olympics in the summer. Now, if I'm planning the Olympics, I'm seriously worried that I'm not going to get the visitor numbers that I thought I was going to get if this virus is still rampant by then. Now, and the other, I suppose, difficult thing is with the scientists, the medical teams are still trying to get to grips with how easy the human-to-human infection can take place, and whether the symptoms show early enough. So if the symptoms aren't showing and you can transmit, then it's much harder to retain. So I think it's a very important thing. It's going to impact all of us, the world economy, and we just have to hope that it is as contained as possible now that the governments and health authorities are so focused on it.
A second question from the students, and it's about the Belt and Road Initiative. And is that focused on small countries? Where will it go? How will it grow? What's the impact?
Well, this is a very favored project by President Xi Jinping himself. It's extraordinary to me that something as prosaically dully named as the Belt and Road Initiative has become such a big thing. It's not exactly snappy. But what it essentially is China looking at both maritime and ground infrastructure trade routes to points right pretty much around the world, but very heavily in Africa and Europe. And just to give you one or two examples, China has been buying ports in various places and operating ports, and some people who are outside China who are very critical of the Belt and Road Initiative think that China is using this as a means of in making the countries dependent on it, creating infrastructure which then they will, the Chinese will at some point grab hold of, because the countries are incurring debt in order to build them. Chinese labor is often very much used rather than local labor. So it's become very controversial, and it's become part of this broad competition between the West and China. The West is, or America in particular, is trying to find alternative ways of appealing to the countries that are very pleased to have investment in their infrastructure. You take a country like Greece, which went through a horrible economic crisis and was then very delighted to have Chinese money coming in to support its ports. But might there be alternatives in a way that doesn't make countries so dependent? So that's part of the controversy over the Belt and Road Initiative. We're doing, by the way, in The Economist, a special report imminently on this. So that'll give you chapter and verse on the Belt and Road.
A third question from our students. What role will space development play in the growth of the United States and Chinese economies in the future decades?
Well, can you permit me a little aside for the moment that this year, 2020, is a big year for Mars exploration. Mars is sort of aligned with Earth in a way this year that creates a window of opportunities for that. So we have a Chinese mission, we have a NASA mission, we also have a UAE, United Arab Emirates, and a European mission. The European rover is called the Rosalind Franklin. Rosalind Franklin was one of the people involved in the uncovering the structure of DNA, and she was my aunt. So it's not every year that you can say my aunt is going to Mars, but sadly she died very young, so it's nice that she's doing it. Anyway, to the bigger question of space exploration, I think the exciting thing about where we are in space. The space industry at the moment is how much of it is now taken up by the private sector, and that's delivered competition and excitement and new possibilities. So we're going to have imminently space tourism. We also have satellites. We have ways of, companies like SpaceX and others are extremely active, and Elon Musk wants to get to Mars, as you probably know. So I think we're in a sort of new era of space, not just at the national level, but also at the private sector level. The unintended part of this, or the consequence of it, is space is also, I'm sure, going to be increasingly militarized. And we've just had the Space Force set up by President Trump. And with so much depending on this digital economy and communications, and so much of that happening through satellites, it becomes a dimension of critical infrastructure.
The next question, that's, excuse me, on gender. Women living longer, will they be the majority of the world leaders, and will they be instrumental in bringing world peace?
The Economist, the editor-in-chief, is a woman. Our chief executive is a woman, and we seem to be doing very well. So I'm all in favour of more this trend, but we've still got a long way to go in the world at large in terms of women taking over the top jobs. And in some parts of the world, it's obviously there's a much bigger way to go than in others. In my publication this year, The World in 2050, there was an interesting piece on Japan and looking ahead for the next 10 years in Japan. Japan is a country that has been far behind many in giving women access to senior roles. But Japan faces this demographic problem, which I mentioned. One of the solutions is to give more opportunities to half the human talent in the country, i.e. the female half. And this piece argued that if you look at the college entry roles of women in Japan, they start to go up significantly in the 1990s. And as that plays its way through the system, the prediction in this piece, which was by former editor-in-chief of The Economist, was that over the coming decade, the 2020s, the number of Japanese women in senior roles, senior executive roles, would double. So I think that sort of pattern, that's countercultural, counterintuitive in Japan, but I think that sort of pattern is going to play itself out in many parts of the world. I would certainly hope so.
Another question, that is, what is the future of the EU?
Well, the future of the EU is Britain-less. But, you know, the EU has maybe without Britain, I think it's many people within the EU regret the departure of Britain. But in a sense, we make life slightly easier because we've always been reluctant about the idea of this ever closer integration. So perhaps without the Brits in there, it will be that much easier to go ahead and have, still not easy because it's still 27 countries now who are often jealous of their own national idea of what Europe should be, and it's not easy to align all those, and you need unanimity on the big things to move forward. But you know what I said, Europe is a diminishing part of the world in terms of its population, in terms of its economic output. So to count in the world, and this is the argument for European integration, Europe needs to do more together. It counts when it acts together in trade negotiations, for example. It's a formidable player. If Europe did more on defense, that would be a good thing, always remembering that it needs to not undermine the NATO alliance, but there's ample scope for using those resources more effectively. And the economies of scale that you get from a big market of 500 million or so people is also very appealing. So I think there are strong arguments for Europe doing more rather than less together in future.
A question that may have two parts. One is, many countries have experienced a rise in populism. Will this trend continue or even possibly increase? And the second part of that is your read on Germany economically and politically.
Gosh, are those two linked? Is someone suggesting there's going to be a rise in populism? Let me take Germany first, because Germany, of course, is the crucial largest economic player in Europe, and it's coming up to, again, this sort of critical period where we've got so used to Angela Merkel as one of the most responsible, I think, steadiest, balanced leaders among the major players, and she's coming up to the end of her time in office by, if she would like to see out this year, and then it would be next year that Germany will have elections. Whether she will manage to see it out is not entirely sure, but that's the hope. And the question of who follows her is the big question facing Germany. You just may have seen in the news they had a big controversy in one of the German states over the far-right party helping one of the state premiers get into office, and they're organizing fresh elections there. So it's very sensitive where the political balance lies now in an increasingly fragmented political scene in Germany. And meanwhile, the German economy is weak right now. Only just avoided a recession at the end of last year. So I think Germany is in for bumpy times. Both China, by the way, is such a big market for German exporters, and that's now not only is China slowing somewhat, but with the coronavirus, that's also a concern. So Germany, I think, faces a tricky period ahead. That's one reason why I think if you look to leadership in Europe as a whole over the coming years, it's Emmanuel Macron in France and probably Boris Johnson who are going to be the larger figures in the next few years. Populism, I'm not sure we've yet reached peak populism, but we'll see. I think that's still got probably a way to run, and that's a concern.
And one last question to say on time, and that is, one half of the population will be in Africa. How will their economy be impacted, and how will it be influenced by China?
Very good question. Just to be clear, it's not one half of the world's population. It's one half of the extra two billion that I said would be in Africa. But clearly, the African Africa is going to be crucial to the future of the world, and Africa has, I think, an opportunity because every other part of the world is now interested in having a piece of that action. And certainly China is extremely interested in Africa, investing very heavily in Africa, but so are other countries as well. And so the critical thing for Africa is to make sure that this new, if you like, scramble for Africa is done in a way that benefits Africans and not the, you know, and as in the old colonial days, that was an extractive operation. So crucial to that is African government's ability to have stability, to have to do the most they can, to have less corruption rather than more of it, and to create the environment where opportunities can come for all these people who are going to be entering into the labor market, so the investment happens there and not the people trying to move to opportunities elsewhere, which would create a challenge for the wider world, particularly, I think, for Europe, which is on the immediate frontier. So it's Africa is in many ways, I think, the pivotal continent for this time horizon of somewhere where things could go spectacularly well, or if things aren't organized as well as they could be, things could also go very badly wrong.
Please join me in saying thank you to someone. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really good day.
Was that all right? Thank you.